The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Okay. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back. So let's carry on where we left off yesterday, and let's see what happens today here. And we have been looking at this sutta, on the gradual training, Majjhima Nikaya number 27, and we have been doing little detours from that sutta, but now we're going to come back to that sutta again and have a look at how it progresses. So the shorter sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint. So we have come to the section on virtue, how to live your life well. We have come to the part after the number two. There's a number two in the text, starting from there and then moving on. So we have looked at how the person gains faith in the Buddha, listens to the teachings. And of course, that listening to the teaching, as I mentioned, is really the arising of right view. You start to look at things in a new way, and you start to realize that you need to change your life, the way you live. Some people then decide to become monastic, some people don't, and that will obviously depend on all kind of circumstances and background and all kind of things. And then that decision to become a monastic or to become a lay follower, that is what is then called right intention. Yeah, the intention to live well, to do the right thing. And that right intention is then often described in the Noble Eightfold Path as the intention of non-ill will, the intention of metta, the avihingsa intention, non-harming of living beings. And the last one is the intention to renounce the nekama vitakka. And of course, renouncing here is very much of what monastic life is about. But lay life also is about renouncing to some extent. Yeah, when you become a lay person, when you take the five precepts, well, you renounce anything which goes against the five precepts, which is a kind of renunciation. Yeah, there's certain things you cannot do anymore, certain harmful things, certain pleasures you cannot indulge in because that goes against the precepts and these kind of things. So there is a renunciation just by taking on the precepts as well. And the more deeply you agree, or the more deeply you commit to practicing a moral life, well, the more renunciation you have to do because it is included in that. But the idea of renunciation, really, nekama, is really what it refers to, is the opposite of kama. Kama meaning the sensory world or sensuality is the opposite of that. So it's kind of the moving away from the sensory world and moving to the inner world of peace and quiet instead. That's really what it means. So this is what we're seeing here, this movement. When you become a monastic, you become a lay follower, right intention. And then the next step on the Noble Eightfold Path after right intention is Samma Vacha and Samma Kammanta, right action and right speech. And when we come here now to the gradual training, we find right action comes first, and then comes right speech. But in the Noble Eightfold Path, it's right speech comes first, and then right action. Why is that? It's a different sequence. Have you seen that before? Have you noticed that? Different sequence. You had to be really interested in the suttas to see these little things, because I always wondered, when you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, right speech comes first, then right action. Why is right speech before right action? And here it is the other way around. Is it significant? I don't think it is very significant. I think maybe the reason why it is different is precisely because it is not significant. So you give different sequence in one place, it means that there isn't really any clear sequence to this. Of course, right intention has to come before right action. Yeah, first of all, you have to want to act in the right way, then you start acting in the right way. But I don't think there is any great significance in right speech or right action coming first. It's just basically the conduct. So let's see what the Buddha has to say about right action there. Yeah, you've gone forth, and then what happens once you've gone forth? Once they have gone forth, they take up the training and the livelihood of the monastics. They give up the killing of living creatures, renounce the rod and the sword. They are scrupulous and kind, living full of compassion for all living beings. Sabbabhuta nukampino, or something like that. So, once you've gone forth, you take up the training and livelihood of the monastics. And that means, basically, it's interesting, the training here is the sikha. And sikha is basically what we're looking at now. This is the sikha, the gradual training. It also includes all the rules of the monastics. But this is what it is about. And the livelihood of a monastic, basically, your livelihood is your alms bowl. Yeah, you go around with an alms bowl, and people, if you're lucky, people give you a little bit of to eat. Usually these days in monasteries, you get a lot to eat, so you're really well looked after. But that is the livelihood, and that is why robes and bowl is kind of the two basic things of a monastic. So mendicant here is the translation by Bhante Sujato, which is... nice, it has the right meaning. It's a little bit old-fashioned, perhaps, but it certainly has the right meaning. Mendicant means someone who receives alms, basically. That's the idea of mendicant. So it means almost exactly the same as the word bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. Bhikkhu means someone who receives alms. Bhikkhuni means the same. So you take on that training, and that training begins with giving up the killing of living creatures. Yeah, renouncing the rod and the sword. Rod is danda, and it literally means like a stick. Yeah, so rod. So, and danda also means punishment. Just like getting stick or whatever in English can mean getting punishment. In the same way, it means exactly that in English as well. So you could argue here it means the giving up of punishment and violence. Sword here is probably just another word for violence. Yeah, it's a slightly metaphorical usage. You give up violence and punishment. That's kind of interesting. You give up punishment. Yeah, you don't punish anyone. When you read the Vinaya, the monastic code, there isn't any real punishment in the ordinary sense. There's something called danda kamma. Danda means punishment, kamma means action. But the kind of punishment you find in the Vinaya is not physical punishment. This is about physical punishment. But it's more about losing your seniority for a while if you act badly, or you might even be expelled from the community of monks if you act in really bad ways. But there's no room or scope for physical punishment in the suttas. And so this idea of punishment doesn't fit with Buddhist ideas. So I think sometimes as societies as well, the idea of punishment, the question is, does it work to punish people? Is it really something that we should do? This idea of vengeance, when someone does something bad in society, we should take revenge. That's not a very Buddhist idea. There's no point in revenge in society. But a lot of the idea of punishment in the world is about taking revenge. Yeah, if you look at how punishment is being used around the world, it's about taking revenge on someone who has behaved badly. But no, the Buddhist idea is about compassion. The Buddhist idea is if someone makes a mistake in society that does something wrong, then we try to understand, we have compassion for that person. They had a difficult upbringing, they had a past life that was difficult, they are deluded, walking in darkness, whatever it is, you have compassion on them. And I think that the Buddhist idea here from this, when people make a mistake, sometimes you have to put them in prison because they are dangerous, but you try to rehabilitate them. Yeah, you don't punish them for punishment's sake, you try to rehabilitate them. How can they become good citizens again? And this is really the right way of thinking from Buddhism. But punishment is not really required. The same thing within the family, or within the Buddhist community. We don't really need to punish each other. We need to have more compassion instead. And this is the thing which kind of stands out about this particular way of talking about the... This is really the first precept, right? Very similar to the first precept about not hurting any living beings. But it also is quite different, because the first precept says, Panatipata Viratmani, I abstain from killing living beings. This one here says, you give up killing living beings, but not only that, you are compassionate and you are kind to living beings. And this adds a dimension to morality. It adds a dimension of how we deal with living beings that is really important. Yeah, it is not enough just to give up the bad thing. And this is what I've been saying all the time about we need to be kind. Yeah, it's not just about giving up the bad stuff. It is about actively doing the good stuff. How can you be kind and compassionate? How can you be more caring towards others? How can we be more helpful? This is really what it is about. So we need to add that extra dimension to how we think about morality. And this comes out in the gradual training here. It does not come out as well in the five precepts. And this is what I mean by the five precepts not being enough. Yeah, we need that extra something more to this whole idea of morality. We need a positive morality, not just the negative morality. So this, if you know the sutta as well, this brings in a very important aspect of what it means, what good karma and bad karma means in the suttas. The way it is defined is defined by intention, and intention in terms is defined by motivation. What is it that motivates you? And it is that motivation that decides whether you are living well or not. What is your motivation? Where are you coming from? It's not just what we do, it's not just the action itself. Yeah, people often ask me, can I do this? Is this good or is this bad? Well, actually, there is no answer to that. Is this good or is it bad? You have to know the person's mind to be able to tell whether something is good or bad. Where are they coming from? This is a very important point. It's a point that I make all the time, but I think it's a very important point of Buddhist ethics. And this is what makes Buddhist morality and Buddhist ideas of living well so different from almost any other kind of system of morality. It is a system based on motivation. Why are we doing things? And what that means, it is a very flexible system of ethics that allows for a very broad, actions that are normally kind of, if you have very strict rules, this is wrong, this is right. If you say you must never kill a living being, and it's irrelevant how you feel about it, why you do it is irrelevant, then you have a very rigid system of ethics. But if you say that it is a motivation-based system of ethics, it opens up new possibilities that otherwise you don't have. And this is what makes Buddhist ethics so interesting and so different from almost any other kind of system of ethics. It opens up, when we talk about things like euthanasia, we talk about things like drug use, we talk about things like even things that are on the surface very bad, like stealing. You start to realize that stealing, it depends enormously on why you are stealing. If you are stealing because you are greedy, it's bad. Yeah. But if you steal because you are in a desperate situation or you try to help somebody, it may not be good, but it's much less bad than if you steal purely out of your own greed. So it's incredible, it's like a grayscale. There's a really dark karma that you do. And then there's a karma which is much less dark. And then there is a really, really bright karma. And there's all the kind of scale in between, depending on what your motivation is. So our job is not always to make the entirely pure white karma, because sometimes it is impossible to make entirely white karma. Yeah, the really bright karma is the karma you make after coming out of samadhi. There's no hindrances in your mind at all. You're completely bright and pure. Very few people have that mind state. Even occasionally it's rare to have that mind state, let alone all the time. So making good cannot always make the very best karma, but you can make better karma. You can approach that pure and white karma. Very often in Buddhism we say, is this good or bad karma? Well, it's not as simple as that. It's not either good or bad, but it is more on the good side or more on the bad side. And that is sufficient sometimes to kind of give us some indication of what we need to do. So perfection is very hard, but we can move in the right way. Yeah, so you try to be as good as you can, and you become pure and pure and pure over time. And eventually, when you have some deep state of meditation, that's when your karma becomes utterly pure and bright. So this kind of adds this beautiful dimension to Buddhist morality. It is about being as kind as we possibly can. Yeah, this is really what it comes down to. And if you remember that much from this, then already you're going to do very well on this Buddhist path. Full of compassion for all living beings. Yeah, it's interesting. I often talk about looking at the parallels to these suttas, and there is a parallel in Chinese translation from the Sarvastivadin school, and it specifically adds not killing insects. It specifically adds that to this particular case, which is kind of interesting. I mean, it's included in all living creatures, but that is actually there specifically. Yeah. So that is the right action, living, giving up the killing, having compassion, supporting life instead. Okay, let's just move on to the next one. They give up stealing. They take only what is given. They expect only what is given. They keep themselves clean by not stealing. So you don't steal. You take only what's given. Well, this is, remember, we're talking about the monastic life here. So this is monastics. You don't really have any other way of livelihood except taking what is given. So you accept that. And you expect only what is given. I think this translation is a bit unfortunate, because it's not all that meaningful. What does it mean, you expect only what is given? It's not very obvious what that is supposed to mean. But I think the better translation is you desire only what is given, I think is better. Because what that means is that not only do you not steal, you don't even think about stealing. Even the idea of stealing doesn't occur to you. Yeah, you don't even desire what is not given. It means a degree of contentment and a degree of purity in the mind that you otherwise would not have. So even just the thought of stealing something is kind of really beyond your outside of your realm of morality. And then you keep yourself clean, pure, by not stealing. And this seems to be the idea that if we steal things, there is like a stain in the mind. Of course, if you kill, then it's really bad. But stealing may not seem so bad, especially if it's something very small or minor or whatever it is. But it kind of leaves a darkness in the mind, a stain in the mind, which makes meditation much more difficult. And this is the problem. This is the idea with meditation practice. That is where you see your own purity. Yeah, you see the purity because it literally leaves a stain on the mind. Yeah, your mind is darkened. It becomes more gray. It is not as bright and beautiful as it would otherwise be. And that grayness and darkness in the mind, you can actually that's what you experience. And that's why how these things block you from achieving better meditation. So the idea here is to not allow yourself those negative aspects that actually block your ability to meditate properly. And this is when we talk about remorse in Buddhism. I remember the famous sutta we talked about, the Dependent Liberation Sutta. It has vipattisari in there. Vipattisari is this idea of remorse or regret. So you practice sila, and then when you practice sila, you don't have any remorse. Avipattisari. So if you have really good sila, really good virtue, you have no remorse. And this is really what we mean by remorse. What we see here is this lack of purity inside, this slight darkness in the mind. When the mind, the nimitta, when it comes up, is not as bright as it would otherwise be. Your mind is a bit more dull because of the things that you have done and the way you have lived. So you want to be as pure as possible, as moral as possible, as you want to build up those positive states within as far as you possibly can. This is what this is about. So what is the opposite of stealing? opposite of stealing is generosity. Yeah, when you steal, you take more for yourself. Yeah, I want more. When you are generous, you give of yourself. Yeah, it's the exact opposite. And why isn't that mentioned here? Well, the reason it's not mentioned is because generosity is such a big part of the Buddhist path that it has separate places where it is talked about. Yeah, it is kind of has its own sort of whole load of suttas that are about the idea of generosity, about the chaganusati, the recollection of generosity, how to be generous. It's kind of fascinating how many suttas there are on how to be generous, especially in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha. It is such an important part of the path, yeah? Because it is the opposite of stinginess, the opposite of holding things for me. Your giving is like the beginning of letting go. Yeah, if you're going to be able to let go in meditation, if you're going to be able to let the world be, leave the world, well, actually, chaga, generosity, is the beginning of that letting go. Because what are we letting go of? Well, what we're letting go of is really these things that are me and mine. Yeah, in meditation, these are my thoughts. Yeah, and if you are attached to that thinking, whatever it is, you won't be able to let it go. If you are attached to being the agent in your life, if you are attached to the sensory world in general, the more attached you are, the less ability you will have to fulfill that meditation or to take that meditation deeply. The beginning of that is generosity, because generosity is an act of letting go, but it is kind of one of the most basic ones. If you want to have success in letting go in meditation, generosity is really a beginning point of all of that. So generosity matters, and this is one of the reasons why generosity often does refer to material generosity, yeah, as a starting point, and why this is important. So this is the positive side, yeah, the kindness as far as not stealing is concerned. The opposite there is again, compassion rising and leading to generosity, the supporting of others, the giving up. And it's a beautiful thing, generosity. I don't know if you, sometimes when you are generous, it leads to very beautiful mind states. Not always, it depends on when you do it and how you do it and all these kind of things. But sometimes it's like, you know, you just want to give. It's like your something inside of you opens up. You want to share with the whole world. You don't want to hold back. That's a beautiful thing when that happens. It leads to a kind of joy, a kind of purity within. When you feel that, you know that this is a spiritual practice. You know there's something very powerful about this. This is what we ideally want to do when we practice generosity. These are the kind of feelings you want to give rise to, because when you have those feelings, that is going to be a very powerful aid in your meditation practice. You will feel good about yourself, yeah? Your heart kind of opens up to the world. You want to share with everyone something very, very wonderful about that. I always like to say that when you look at someone, how spiritually advanced they are, you can see in their generosity how spiritually advanced they are. And some of the people that I know who are the most spiritual advanced, they always give. Yeah, someone who is always, you know, you ask them, I mean, some of the people who are most spiritually advanced that I know obviously are going to be monastics, because that's the people I know the closest. And also that's where the path is practiced the furthest usually. And this willingness to give, yeah, and share with other people, that's just endless. Yeah, just giving, giving, giving. And knowing also when to stop, knowing when to stop when your energy is depleted or whatever, but otherwise just giving, living a life purely for giving. And this is the life of the Buddha. Remember what I was saying in the beginning, that the Buddha had no interest in teaching. He doesn't want people to kind of be his disciples. In fact, for the Buddha, disciples are just a hassle. Yeah, he doesn't want all these people hanging around. It means that he has less time for samadhi or whatever. So the Buddha has no interest. He only lives for one reason, that is generosity. That's the only thing, only reason why he lives the way he does and teaches others. The more spiritually advanced you are, the more generous you are in different ways, yeah? Giving of yourself endlessly, ultimately. This is why this is so important at this stage of the path, even at the beginning, because you are leaning in the right direction. You're moving towards that. And try to remember what you're doing when you're generous. remember what it is that you are doing, what you're taking part of. And the more you understand what you are taking part of, the more powerful it becomes. What does it mean to support a Buddhist cause? What does it mean to help someone, like, you know, like you come and you offer food and someone like Ajahn Brahm or some kind of, you know, very well practiced person is here? What are you supporting here? And what you are supporting is not just Ajahn Brahm. What you are supporting is this spread of these teachings in the world. And when these teachings spread in the world, if people take them on board, if people really do become more kind and more caring, you are creating a better world. You're creating less suffering. You're creating more happiness in people's lives. And every time you support somebody who does that, you have a share in that creation of happiness in the whole world. Millions of people listen to some of these talks by Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, and millions of people get better lives. They have less suffering. They have more happiness in their life. They have more contentment. They have more understanding. And then that ripples out to people around them, their families, their workplaces. The benefit is enormous. So remember, when you support something like this, some kind of the encouragement to live better, to have more better lives, you are supporting something vast and enormous going out into the world. These are simple ways of thinking, of improving that sense of generosity. Yeah? You just give. Don't overthink it either. If you overthink it, it becomes, again, you kind of destroy it by thinking too much about it. But just have these kind of feelings. Yeah, wow, what a wonderful thing it is to support this. Especially people who are very advanced on the path, you know, it always says in the suttas, if you support someone who is very advanced, it is more powerful. And very often it's because you know when you are in the presence of someone with really good qualities, you can feel that. You can feel something going on. And then you give to that. And there's something that kind of brings out the faith and confidence. Yeah, you can feel that this, yes, you really want to give. You really want to support. I don't know about you, but I know with myself, if it's very much easier for me to... Very easy to, you know, when Ajahn Brahm is there to do a little act of service or something, it comes quite naturally because basically you have a lot of confidence in someone like Ajahn Brahm. You know, after living with him for almost 30 years, that, you know, the qualities that are there. And it's easy to support someone with those qualities. It comes naturally. There's more faith there. And that brings up a lot of those beautiful qualities when you act with kindness. You feel good about it afterwards. Helps your meditation. The whole path kind of takes off. So not stealing. Whoa, that's not stealing, right? That's really not stealing. That's the anti-stealing. Giving away like that. Not desiring anything. Only what's given. And you keep yourself super duper pure by not stealing and by being generous instead. You give up unchastity. You are celibate, set apart, avoiding the common practice of sex. So this means that you, here in this case, it means that you have no sexual activity. Yeah, you avoid all sexual activity. That's really what it means. And some of these words are a bit ambiguous. And so this is like the monastic path again. And you know that in the Noble Eightfold Path, it talks about this. And there, what it talks about is sexual misconduct. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, it's more inclusive. It is very clearly meant for lay life, whereas this here is more meant for monastic life. That is quite nice, though, because it means that you know that the Noble Eightfold Path is for lay people. Yeah, it is kind of phrased in such a way, so it must be for lay people. It's phrased in that sense. So you give this up. Why do we give this up? People say, don't want to give it up. Yeah, this is asking too much. This is what life is about. This is such an important part of life. There's no chance I'm going to give these things up. And this is what people are about when they say, oh, I want to live an ordinary lay life and I also want to live the meditation and do the I would have both sides. Yeah, they're both important and I can't have just one or the other. And fair enough, you know, there's nothing wrong with enjoying life. We should all enjoy life to some extent. But the point here is not so much that you have to give up sexuality. That's not really the point. The point is that if you want to go really deep in your meditation, if you want to really take it all the way, then you have to give up those things that are a hindrance to meditation. And like we said before, the problem is that as long as you are attached to that sensory world, it means the mind goes out there. And we don't want the mind to go out. We want the mind to stay within. Yeah, and for the mind to stay within, to not be attached to external things, you have to hold back on some of those things that are the most interesting in the sensory world. And sexuality is often the most powerful of all the defilements. Yeah, it can be a very, very strong defilement. And so to be able to not be attached to that world, you have to let go of this to some extent. So the opposite of indulgence in sexuality is actually meditation practice. When you go within, you stay within. The mind doesn't go out to that world outside. This is the opposite. So this is why we do this. It's not because we want to torture people, but it's to give people access to deep meditation. This is really what this is about. It's important to understand these things because if we understand them, then it becomes possible to practice accordingly. We know what is going on, why we do this. So this is the brahmacharya, the conduct of Brahma. That's what it means in Pali. Brahmacharya. Charya means conduct. This is what Brahma does. Brahma has metta and kindness and compassion and is celibate because you live kind of independently in that kind of realm. So, there you are. So that is right conduct. Three kinds of right conduct. And you will notice there are certain things that aren't mentioned there. Yeah. What about torturing people? Doesn't say anything about not torturing people. Doesn't say anything about being violent or anything like that. You renounce rod or sword. I suppose that is that kind of heading in that direction. But it doesn't specifically say torturing. So one of the things to remember here is that not everything is necessarily mentioned in this. This is an approximation to morality. There may be things that are not mentioned here. There is, it's interesting, in the monastic circles, one of the most interesting aspect of kind of the rules of the monks, and we're talking in the monastery, maybe we should have a session on this, like a teaching session, is the loopholes in the rules. The loopholes, that's kind of the most, that's what people often, and sometimes when you hear Vinaya teachings, the Vinaya teachings are more about the loopholes than the actual rules that you have to keep. Well, no, I'm exaggerating, it's not really about that. But we were saying, maybe we should have a whole session just on loopholes. And that is kind of dangerous, because you can always find loopholes in these things. But this is not about getting away with things. Remember, this is not about if I keep these rules very strictly within the limits, I can get away with certain things. Well, you can't get away with anything. That's the problem. Because this is not about following rules. It's about what gives rise to purity. And so you don't never get away with anything. So you have to remember here that when you act and you live, it is about what is actually right, what is moral, where are you coming from, what is your motivation? Are you motivated by greed? And sometimes we are, and the moment you're motivated by greed, you want to find the loopholes, I wonder, what is the loophole here? How can I avoid? I don't really want to give anything away. How can I avoid giving? So what is the, I need this, this is important for me, or something like that. Or I've got to steal, or I'm really, really hungry, and you have one extra cake, you don't need that. You're looking away, quick, take that cake, I don't know if anyone does that, but remember that, this is about purity. All of these things are very significant. So know your mind state. At the end of the day, that's what matters. Where are you coming from? What is driving you? And if you are driven by kindness, by care, by generosity within, wanting to do the right thing, then you're always safe. So you don't even have to remember these rules. All you have to remember is kindness. You have to remember to be kind. So if that's all we have to remember, why are we talking about all these things? Why are we worried about the five precepts if all we have to remember is one word, and that's kindness? And maybe no need, right? Maybe we're just wasting our time talking all this talking for no reason whatsoever. And the answer is, I think, that sometimes when the mind is clouded, we don't know anymore what is kind and what is not. Sometimes you get really confused. You can't see straight. You don't know up from down, back from front, and light from dark, and green from red, or whatever it is. Everything becomes confused. And when you are confused, it's very useful to have some very clear rules about what you can do. Okay, this mosquito is really irritating. I can't sleep. The mosquito must die. Yeah, wait a minute. There's a rule against killing. Okay, better not kill that mosquito, right? I don't know what you feel about killing mosquitoes, but anyway, that's kind of the ideal in Buddhism, not to even kill mosquitoes. So you know that. So you have a rule. It makes it very clear what you have to do. So the rules have a purpose. But in the end, morality is about where we are coming from, what our intentions are, compassion. So this is what you need to think about in daily life. This is where you really purify your conduct, having compassion for everyone, everything, even the difficult things, even Ajahn Mosquito. Have compassion for Ajahn Mosquito. That's what Ajahn Brahm calls Mosquito, Ajahn Mosquito, the real teacher. Forget about people like Ajahn Nisarana and myself. We're not real teachers. The mosquito, that's the real teacher. You go back to your room and the mosquito is buzzing. That's when you really learn about compassion and understanding. And it's true, isn't it? This is the theory. The real deal is when you actually have to, when you're confronted with these things and you have to make the right decisions. That's the real teachers in life. Anyway. So how do we have compassion for mosquitoes? Is it really possible? Can it be done? Or it can be done. Okay, wow, you are very advanced practitioners in here. You have compassion for mosquitoes. Whoa. Many people find it hard. Yeah, mosquitoes and cockroaches. How can you have compassion for a cockroach? And people don't like these animals, right? Because they're kind of dirty and you don't want these things and you feel really bad about them. So what you need to do is you need to look at that being in a different way. And so much in Buddhism and in life is about looking at things in the right way, understanding where they are coming from. What do you think it feels like to be a cockroach? Imagine yourself as a cockroach. Not very pleasant, perhaps, but imagine that you are a cockroach, right? And you are this tiny little being, and that is enormous beings, running around, trying to kill you, having a shoe, trying to smack you over the head. Imagine what that feels like. It's incredibly scary. Really, really scary when that happens. And you run as fast as you possibly can. And you don't know that you are ugly. You don't know that you are full of disease. You have no idea what's going on. You're just a living being. And this is how you were born. And imagine what it is like to be a cockroach. Or imagine what it's like to be a mosquito. You're just flying around. You're just having your meal. Everyone has a right to a meal. Unfortunately, that meal is kind of in a place where it irritates these vast beings with incredible powers, these gods. They are so powerful, they can kill you with one smack. You're dead. Wow, these are so powerful, these beings. And for them, that's what we look like. We look like these really powerful, godlike creatures with amazing kind of technology and what have you. So remember that. And when you start to understand that they want to live just like us, they are frightened. They just want to carry on. Then you start to have compassion for these little beings. It's called anthropomorphizing, kind of seeing them as humans in a sense, because they are much more similar to us than we think. They are also different in many ways, but there are a lot of similarities. This is how you gradually build up this, and many people find these things hard, but this is kind of, if you can have compassion for a mosquito, then you can have compassion for a lot. Really? Wow. That's really cool. Yeah, that's really great. Okay. Ken is an advanced practitioner. He's ahead of most people. Thank you for letting us know, Sue. He would never say that himself, but it's good that you can say those things. Great. All right. So that is about the idea of kindness, and so in action. Let's come to kindness in speech. That's the next one. So now comes, so this is often divided up in Buddhism, action, speech, and mind. Yeah. So we have now looked mostly at the action part, the body part. Now we come to the speech part. So you give up lying here. You speak the truth and stick to the truth. You're honest and trustworthy. You don't trick the world with your words. So you don't lie. Yeah, but it's not just that you don't lie. Again, you see here the opposite again of lying. You're actually honest. Yeah, you try to tell things as they are. You're not tricky. You don't try to trick the world. You don't think, how can I get away with kind of telling half-truths because the truth is just too painful. And then you are honest about things. And so giving up lying is a very important part of life. Why do people lie? It's kind of fascinating. And you can lie for a large number of reasons. Yeah, you can lie to gain benefits, of course. But often we lie because of self, of ego. Yeah, we are afraid to be honest because we might look bad or we would feel bad about ourselves if we are honest. Is it true that you broke that precept? No, I didn't break that precept. Actually, maybe you did, yeah, but you have to be honest about doing something bad. And there are many things in our life we're not really proud about, yeah, that we don't really want others to see or know. But we shouldn't be so afraid of other people knowing these things that we think are secret. Other people probably do exactly the same. And sometimes if we are open about our own shortcomings, it allows other people too to be more relaxed about their own shortcomings instead of pretending to be better than we are. Yeah. So sometimes it's okay to be open about one's shortcomings and to say these things because it allows everyone to relax a little bit more. Yeah. Okay, I'm not perfect. I'm not the only one who is imperfect. Reducing that sense of self can be a good way to be more honest in your life, not lying so much. And most of you here are probably very honest people already, but we can always improve. Remember, we're talking about the grayscale here, yeah? Again, it's like the really dark kind of lying. I want something for myself. I want to hurt somebody through lying. And then there's the really kind of lying, which is somewhere in between. You lie because you want to protect somebody, yeah? And that can happen. You're motivated by compassion, but you lie. It's not ideal, but it's not very bad either. And then there's the kind of truth-telling, yeah, which is beautiful speech, which comes with truth at the same time, which is very bright and beautiful. So there's all of these things. So, you negotiate these things wisely. When you do that, then you find the right balance. Again, it's a matter of where you're coming from, what motivates you, what is driving you, are you being kind or not, and then you're on the right track. So let's lying, sticking to the truth. Then we have a divisive speech. They don't repeat in one place what they heard in another so as to divide people against each other. Instead, they reconcile those who are divided, supporting unity, delighting in harmony, loving harmony, speaking words that promote harmony. So, very big emphasis here on promoting harmony. It's very beautiful the way this is phrased. I have always loved this little things here by the Buddha, these ideas that we have here. Yeah, it's just so, I don't know, it's just very much, it's so different from how often we live in our society. Our society is often very divided, and we're very good at pointing out the flaws in other people sometimes and seeing the negative in them instead of actually seeing the good parts in them, trying to find compassion to excuse them for their mistakes, yeah? And then when other people complain, say, well, sure, okay, they're not perfect, but look at it this way, yeah? They had a hard day, had a difficult upbringing, they had something in their past life or whatever. Look at it in a new way and try to bring people together. Or you may disagree about things, yeah, but you don't kind of, you're not harsh with each other just because you disagree about something. Yeah? And there's a lot here to be dealt with. There's a lot here to be done. You know, I have been part of the BSWA, Buddha Society Western Australia, for a long time. And I've been here coming to the BSV for many years. And within Buddhist societies everywhere, there is often, especially at the committee levels, there's often disharmony. Yeah, people finding it hard to really work together and finding it hard. And really, it shows you that a lot of Buddhists, they can do much more in their practice. Yeah, ideally, if we really practice Buddhism fully, every one of us, we would not have that kind of disharmony within a Buddhist society. Yeah, or maybe it is the kind of people who get elected to committees that are a bit sort of are a bit tougher than others. I don't know what it is. Or maybe the committees bring out all the worst sides in people. I'm not sure what it is. And it's not always the case. Sometimes committees can be quite harmonious. It just varies a lot. But sometimes it brings out the thing in people. Yeah. And so how can we have more harmony? And again, it's about, first of all, having less of an ego in your own life, not feeling that things have to go your way. Yeah, being willing to compromise. Compromise is one of those beautiful things in life, because compromise means that you understand you don't always have the full picture. Other people are going to be right in part. And because other people are going to be right in part, you accept that, you know, your own limitations in a sense. And then you compromise. Compromise is a very, very beautiful thing, and we should all do more of that in our lives. And compromise tends to bring harmony in. So don't have too much ego. Yeah, it's not about you. It's about the BSV. We want the BSV to function together properly, to move forward. It's not about getting your ideas through. It's about finding something which is acceptable. And I know Ajahn Brahm has this really nice saying. I haven't heard him say it for a while, but he used to say that it is not so important which decision is made. Yeah, what we decide is not so important. More important is how we carry it through. Because very often we don't know what the right decision is. Yeah, we are all kind of slightly in the dark. Okay, are we going to build the retreat center in Newbury this way or that way? What is the right answer to that? And sometimes it's very hard to say. Yeah, the consequences are just unfathomable sometimes. Good, bad, who knows, right? You know the story, good, bad, who knows, right? If you've been around Ajahn Brahm for a while, you know exactly what good, bad, who knows means. We don't know whether something is bad. We lose our finger. We put the doctor in jail because we lost our finger. And then it turns out he saved your life, yeah, down the track. Yeah. That's the story of good, bad, who knows. If you haven't read it, check it out. Yeah, it's a really nice story. And it's a story about life, about uncertainties. In the long run, what actually is good for us is incredibly hard to gauge. And so we are in the darkness. So that's why we shouldn't be too concerned about outcomes. If we sense that there could be disharmony or whatever, we let go of our opinion. Okay, whatever, I can deal with it. I can, you know, down the track, I don't agree necessarily. And of course, you are allowed not to agree. But sometimes you give up your opinion, even though you think you're right. And that is a beautiful thing to do. You do it out of compassion. You do it for harmony. You do it to bring people together. And sometimes we're not very good at this in this world of ours. We all want things our way. And yeah, so harmony, yeah? And one of the interesting things in the suttas that you find that harmony is a foundation for meditation to work. There is a sutta which talks about disharmony in the Sangha. And when there is disharmony in the Sangha, everyone is arguing, then there is no joy anymore. When there is no joy, then your meditation doesn't work. There is no happiness or peace in your meditation. You can't get samadhi. The whole idea of the Buddhist path falls apart. Harmony is one of those fundamental things that make the path work. If you want to feel good about yourself, you have to have harmony between people. If I go back and start an argument with Ajahn Nisarana, then it's not going to be no. It's only three rooms over there living so close together. If we haven't, can imagine what that house is going to be like if we have an argument. Oh, it's going to be very unpleasant. Have we ever had an argument before, Alessandro?
We had discussions.
maybe they got a little bit heated, but then we kind of cooled down very quickly again. I don't think we have ever had any real arguments. We have known each other for almost 30 years. Yeah, 1994 is when we met. Never really had an argument. So, but it's very hard to have an argument with Ajahn Nisarana, I must admit. Really, really difficult. So this is kind of the ideal we should all strive for. both within monastics and as lay people, because it leads something very positive. It leads to an outcome where the spiritual life really is possible. Should have harmony on committees. We should have harmony everywhere. You can have a good discussion. Sometimes you have to have a good discussion. But when you feel it's going too far, then okay, cool down. And let's find the middle way where everyone can be happy and can work with it. So sometimes we need to try harder to follow the Buddha's teachings. Sometimes we don't try hard enough. We forget in our daily life what these things are about. Come back to the idea of kindness. Once there is disharmony, you know that kindness has gone out of the window. Just looking at the windows over here. So it goes out the window. Dick! Gone. Right now the problem is not going out the window, it's coming in through the window is a bigger problem, actually. All this kind of machinery outside. So this reminds you of how uncertain things are. You never know next time the machinery comes. Every peaceful moment is kind of should be savored, because it is rare to find. Okay, let's come down to the other third aspect of right speech. You give up harsh speech. Speech which is kind of tough and harsh and get lost and that kind of thing. Actually, that's what Ajahn Brahm says. He says, get lost. Have you seen that? In one of his books, it starts off, he has a preface to his book, and is it the Art of Disappearing, something like that? Yeah. And he has a preface, and at the very end he says, may you get lost, Ajahn Brahm. That's what he has. And he kind of punning on the word of getting lost, or disappearing, this kind of things. So sometimes getting lost is good, but sometimes it's not so good, depending on the situation, right? Nothing is one-sided. You give a harsh speech. You speak in a way that is mellow, pleasing to the ear, lovely, going to the heart, polite, likable, and agreeable to the people. Very, very nice. You, the kind of speech you want to hear when someone speaks. So that is beautiful way of thinking. And it says elsewhere in the suttas, it says specifically that harsh speech leads away from samadhi. It is like it stirs up the mind, harsh speech. There's a callousness there, a kind of lack of caring, a harshness to the world that blocks samadhi from arising. Samadhi sangvatanika, leading away from samadhi. So that is kind of specific. Too harsh speech, that it has that immediate effect of taking away, blocking your samadhi as a consequence of that harshness. So you have that gentleness. That gentleness should come out in how you speak. Say again? That's a good point. I was going to say that, actually, but I was afraid of praising him too much. So I thought, how can I say that without praising him? Actually, you can't really praise anyone too much. It's true. Ajahn Nisarana is kind of the master of gentle speech. That's actually very true. Very good point. Thanks for pointing that out. So that is the avoidance of harsh speech. Let's come to the very last one. They give up talking nonsense. Their words are timely, true, and meaningful, in line with the teaching and the training. They say things at the right time, which are valuable, reasonable, succinct, and beneficial. The Pali word for nonsense is sampapalapa. It sounds nonsense, like nonsense, sampapalapa. And sampapalapa is like talking, and sampa is like rubbish. So it's rubbish talk, really. A talk which is kind of pointless or whatever. And it's interesting. I remember going to Indonesia. Those of you who speak a bit of Bahasa, do you speak Bahasa, Ken? Yeah? Okay. So if you go to Indonesia or Bahasa, the rubbish bin is a sampah. Rubbish is called sampah, right? And that comes probably from Pali or from Sanskrit. That's where, because there's a lot of Sanskrit words in Indonesian and Bahasa language. So that's one of them, the rubbish bin, yeah. And I remember going to Indonesia and I was talking about this thing and everyone started laughing, yeah. Sampah, because the rubbish bin was there talking about rubbish speech. it's fascinating when you travel like that and you kind of see the connections in the Buddhist world. Because Indonesia, that whole archipelago of Indonesia and parts of Malaysia and that whole area was Buddhist very early on. And Sanskrit had a very powerful influence on that area, yeah. So you go there, lots of words that are still kind of comes from Sanskrit and Pali in that area. And so, yeah. Anyway, so this is like rubbish talk, yeah? Talk which is kind of meaningless. And instead of that, you have words that are timely. Yeah? You know the right time to speak. Yeah? A lot of the time, it is not really the right time. It's better to be quiet. That's why we call things noble silence, because silence is often very noble. Sometimes people feel awkward about being silent. But I think in a Buddhist society such as this, we should never feel awkward about being silent. It's okay to be silent, yeah? Don't need to talk all the time. And after a while, you feel very comfortable being silent. It's a bit like when you live with a partner for a long time. After a while, you don't talk so much anymore. You just live in the house together, two people. There's no need to talk a lot because you're very comfortable with each other. And sometimes you're just quiet around each other, and that's fine. And in a Buddhist society like this, we can be a bit like that, yeah? It's okay to be quiet around each other. No need to feel awkward or anything like that. This compulsion to speech, I think, is one of the kind of, maybe scourge is a too strong a word, but it's kind of a bad thing in society, yeah? And societies vary quite a lot. I come from Norway originally, and Norway is a much less kind of... much less a verbal society probably than English. Traditionally, people didn't talk so much. Finland is even more like that. The Finnish people don't talk at all, almost. If you talk, you look at one. What? Talk again? No, enough talking. There was a famous joke. Ajahn Brahma, I don't only tell jokes very rarely, but this is a joke about how the Finnish and they're talking. There's this sauna is a Finnish word, right? Sauna is like a hot bathhouse, you go inside and you steam yourself up 100 degrees or whatever. There's two men in a Finnish sauna. They're sitting there. Yeah, there's one is called Pekka, and the other one is called Petteri or something like that. That's the kind of classical Finnish names. Yeah, just because I come from that part of the world, I know these things. Pekka says after 15 minutes in the sauna, there's complete silence. No one speaks because this is Finland. After 15 minutes, Pekka says to Petteri, "How are you, Petteri?" And the complete silence again, another 15 minutes. And after 15 minutes, Petteri says to Pekka, "Are we here to drink or to talk?" Because drinking is what the Finns, they shouldn't be doing that, but that's what they do in the saunas, right, sometimes. So this is kind of Finland, yeah? It's probably not as funny for you as it is if you are from that part of the world. If you're from that part of the world, it's really funny because you know exactly this fits with the stereotypes. So cultures are very different, and English-speaking cultures are often very verbal cultures. And so people speak, and if they don't speak, they feel uncomfortable very often. But really, from a Buddhist point of view, often it is you say what is necessary to be polite and nice. You don't have to talk a lot. Instead, you speak words that are timely at the right time, true and meaningful, of course, in line with the teaching or the training, or even it could also be about the teaching and the training. Dhammavadi, Vinayavadi are the words here. The word Vinaya, you might think it means the monastic law, the monastic rules, but actually the more basic meaning of Vinaya is actually training here. Yeah? So it is about the training, how we can live in a good way. You say things that are valuable, nidana vatti, that are to be treasured. Yeah, quite literal. Nidana is a treasure in Pali. These are words that are to be treasured. They are reasonable in the sense that they are built on, they are sensible words that are built on good reasons and good causes. Yeah, this is sappadana is the Pali word there. Succinct. Yeah, then don't go on forever. You talk. That's a good sign. Actually, that's a good point. I shouldn't go on forever. It's just turned 10 o'clock, so that's kind of a good timing here. It's reasonably succinct. You don't stretch things out more than necessarily. And not last but not least, it is atta sanghita. It is connected with what is beneficial and what is good. Beneficial words. that you use. So there you are. That's the talking of things that are frivolous. Yeah, and I think I'm not sure if nonsense is quite right, but frivolous talk that is kind of meaningless. So those are the four kinds of right speech. It's very useful to remember these things because it's easy to forget. And important to remember that these things are also in order. There is a specific order here. Lying is the worst. Divisive speech is the second worst. Harsh speech is third. And the last one, fortunately, is frivolous speech. So if you do a bit of frivolous speech, you are not. It's not. It's okay. Yeah. It's not the worst thing. Yeah. So which is kind of useful to know. So remember, there's always a sequence in Buddhism. In the suttas, things come in a particular order, and that order matters. And that is true also here for the kind of speech that we can and cannot do. So that's it. Well, that is a lot in an hour. It may not look like a lot, but actually it's a lot, because these are very, very important principles. And we should really ideally talk much more about the idea of morality and how it works in Buddhism. But I think that's enough to kind of give you a good feel for this particular topic. So there you are. So as always, we're going to stop there. Please have a marvelous lunch. And we'll see you back again at 2:00 this afternoon.